For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. With me, two of the most intelligent cave dwellers you're ever going to be dealing with, Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. On the way in this morning, I was reading headlines and came across one that I found particularly disturbing, and it seems to be a pattern with the group called ISIS, who have established their own caliphate within the Middle East. Everywhere they go, if there are religious symbols or religious icons of any type, from the ancient historical periods, their first concept is simply destroy them, wipe them out, erase them. What I was reading about this morning is that one of the oldest monasteries, Christian monasteries, in the world was leveled this week by ISIS. They're wiping out the history. They're wiping out the beauty. What does philosophy tell us about our history, about the beauty within the church and within the world?
Yeah, what ISIS is doing, destroying these artifacts, and it's not only Christian artifacts. I mean, when the Taliban came into Afghanistan, they destroyed a lot of ancient Buddhist temples. And, we've talked a lot about how Christianity and Islam differ. And the militant Islam that's represented by ISIS, by the Taliban, by these other more militant groups, I think one of the big ways that they contrast with Christianity is this reaction to ancient artifacts, artwork, and beauty in general. That Christianity, we've got a long tradition, particularly in Catholicism, of preserving artworks. And we preserve all artworks. I mean, you go to the Vatican and it's full of pagan antiquities from Rome and ancient Greece. And so we have a certain reverence for the created work that at least the militant brand of Islam doesn't seem to have.
Yeah, it's really tragic to think about the destruction of that monastery, because it's irreplaceable. Now that it's been destroyed, there really is no good way to reconstitute or reconstruct it. And so it does point, I think, fellas, to something that's a very dangerous strain of misunderstanding that seems to be running through some of this militant Islam about this profound, sort of hatred, if you will, or violence towards the beautiful. And I think for those listening here to the Cave, that's going to be our topic. We're really going to look at beauty today, aesthetics, that branch of philosophy that's going to incorporate things like music and artwork and objects of art. So as a way to hopefully help us understand why it's important to have these things and to cherish and preserve them.
Yeah, most of us feel it sort of at a gut level when you hear stories about artworks being defaced or destroyed, whether it's Islam that's doing it or whether it's something else that's destroying it, just progress. You've got beautiful buildings from centuries old that are leveled in the name of so-called progress. We all sort of feel that tragedy at a gut level, but what is it? Why is it that we recognize that a building that's 400 to 500 years old somehow is important to preserve, even if at this point its functionality is kind of minimal or compromised? We still at a gut level recognize that's important to preserve. And same thing with really any work of fine art. We recognize this is important to preserve. From time to time you'll hear of a revival of a lost piece of artwork. And people get excited. They'll go and they'll see it. They have no idea what this thing's going to be like. I mean, it could be a disaster. But people want to go see it just simply because it's an old piece of art. And so there's something about the antiquity of art that captures us and makes us say, oh, it's valuable just simply because it's old.
Right. I think one of the things about art as it connects to, or beauty as it connects to the human person philosophically is that when we think, I think of like, say, a Michelangelo, and I think about imagine, you know, a large hunk of marble, just a big, huge, like 8-ton chunk of marble. And then he sets to work on it. Michelangelo sets to work on it, right? He becomes, as Aristotle told us, he becomes sort of this efficient cause. He's the one who's going to attack this block of marble, and he's going to what? In a certain sense, he's going to bring out something beautiful that he's already envisioned, imagined, that's already inside, like the Pietà, right? And he's going to pull that out, and he's, in a sense, he sees a form in there, and it's a form, the object, say, of the Pietà, which is, for those listening, if you're not familiar, that's that beautiful, it's just magnificent, right? There's nothing quite like it, of the Blessed Virgin Mary holding the crucified dead body of our Lord. And it's captivated. Anyone who's seen it, even just pictures of it, much less in person, are captivated by it. But it represents this transformation, right, from a sort of a big chunk of hunk of marble into something that represents and captures the essence of one of the most beautiful tragedies of all history, is something that any human being ought to respond to. It evokes a response from us.
Right. And, you know, there's a couple of different theories about why it evokes that response. One, if you go back to the idea that there are forms of things that we recognize that are not the individual instances of those forms. So I see you sitting across from me, Tim, but I know you're a human being because I recognize the form of a human
being.
Barely.
Remember, I'm a cave dweller.
Yeah. And that form of the human being transcends Tim. So right. Tim's an individual man, but the idea of a human being goes far beyond Tim. And same thing with birds and cars and other things. There's an essential form that when we see a bird off in the distance, we recognize it as a bird, even if we don't know what type of bird or we can't even see what color it is. We recognize it as a bird. And so one theory about artwork is when we produce that form in a work of art, in a marble or in paint on a painting, we're reproducing that form in its purest state. And so what we respond to is how close that artist gets to the form or how far away he is. And that we do as an estimation or judgment of beauty.
That's such an important point. And that also makes it calls to mind for me an important distinction between living organisms versus artifacts. So the difference between, say, a sculpture in marble versus the bird is that the bird has, in its very nature, from the moment of its conception, if you will, within it, it has that organizing principle where the final form is already built into it. So the bird is simply going to develop as an organism into its final form, where when we look at artifacts, so non-living things, the hunk of marble that then has to be have an efficient cause, like an artist, like a Michelangelo, has to impose the form on it. And it's to the extent, I think, that you were just talking about how well that is done. So for example, if Michelangelo were here right now and we both had the same tools, the same hunk of marble to begin with, he and I are going to arrive at two very different aesthetically pleasing or displeasing objects when we're done, because he had a rare genius to bring out that form, when he imposed that form, to bring out that kind of beautiful reality in a way that I lack those skills.
And what's interesting is you would think then that the most perfect work of art would be the most imitative. In other words,
you'd think, but I bet it's not.
It's not, exactly. You know, we're sitting in here in the studio of Catholic Radio, and on the wall, of course, since it's a Catholic radio, we have a crucifix. And so one of the big questions of aesthetics is what makes a beautiful crucifix? How do you have a beautiful depiction of the crucifixion? And that's probably one of those that if you presented it in its most realistic form, it would be the ugliest.
Yeah, the most repulsive.
The most repulsive, exactly. And so a beautiful crucifixion brings out the reality and essence of what's going on in the crucifixion in a beautiful form that's not necessarily a complete imitation of what we would see if we saw a real crucifixion in front of us.
Yeah, that's such an important point to make. I think, too, as we move here through this program, we've been talking about beauty in terms of objects. But I also think we're going to want to expand that a little bit, too, and think about beauty, again, as a beauty, as a branch of philosophy is called aesthetics. And with that, I want to make sure that we bring in Kent into the conversation. Kent's our trusty companion and producer, but he's also quite a musician and an expert in that field. And so, Kent, let me ask you, before we only got a little time before we're going to take our first break, tell us a little bit about what you think the connection is between beauty and music. Because I can play the kazoo, but I've and create a kind of music, but it's never been called beautiful.
It's one of those things, in my mind, we have been granted the senses that we have to experience the world. We see a bird, we see a sunrise, we connect to that beauty. With our ears, we connect to sound. Whether that sound is, you know, waves lapping on the shore, a bird singing, or, you know, the most gorgeous pipe organ ever created. All these things touch us in a way that we look at these as things that the Creator has put out there for us to experience. We'll get more into this right after the break, guys.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just two words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then, below that, in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. Guys, just before we went to break, we started talking a little bit about music in the church, art in the church, things like that. It all falls down, in my mind, under the category of liturgy. And liturgy is the work of God. When we take a look at, for example, the Mass, there are all kinds of various beautiful pieces that fit together in the Mass. There's the Word of God, there's the sacrifice, but there's also the sanctuary that we're in, there's the music, there's the language, and, you know, how do those really come together to fulfill the work of liturgy?
There's a lot packed into that question. So
I'll say.
let's take a step back and let's look at it. I think when you're looking at aesthetics, you've got two things going on. You've got the work of art, and you've got what that's transmitting and communicating. And then you've got the experience of the viewer of that, the aesthetic mm-hmm. experience, etc. And so, you know, I think we get into this state of mind when we look at art of, well, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. There's nothing objective there. It's all very subjective as to what I think about it or what I believe about it. But really, any artist will tell you, and I mean, you'll tell us this, Kent, as a musician, that the aesthetic experience is very much controlled to a certain extent by the artist. And so I think one of the things that's going on in liturgy is everything should be, ought to be, designed to put us in a state of mind where our souls are being uplifted to God so that we become part of the experience of what's going on at Mass.
You know, and I think there's a very valid point to that, in the fact that what we experience as individuals and as a community at Mass is very much dictated not only by what we feel, but what we see others experiencing. For example, back when I used to do a contemporary music group at my former parish, there was one individual that was in that group, and it was always just, in my mind, an awe-inspiring feeling to watch as she would sing, and you could actually tell almost physically when she had gone from just singing to a state of praying through song. And it almost gave you chills if you could just recognize that moment. I know I'd seen it. There were several others who had commented on it. It's a matter of the art transcending the art itself and becoming something more.
Well, that's part of the connection, I think, that we are hoping to make between this aesthetics that we've been talking about and our personal experience. Mark, you were just laying out these kind of two tracks, if you will, when we think about aesthetics. And I think it's really important, too, that you mentioned that, you know, it's not just all up for grabs when it comes to appreciating beauty. I mean, there are ways in which reasonable people ought to be able to make sound aesthetic judgments about various kind of works of art and an experience of beauty. So, for example, one might think it peculiar if you're at a particularly beautiful location, say a tropical beach at sunset, and you know, the person you're with kind of goes, "Barf! Yeah, this is just awful. Get me out of here. I need to go back. You know, I need to be somewhere else. I don't want to be around." No, you'd think, well, I see this beautiful sunset. The sort of a universal response would be, wow, look at the majesty of that. And it begins to lift our hearts, our minds, and our souls beyond to what? Points to what? The Creator, right? So there's kind of a natural theological component to that. And someone who's sort of repulsed by a beautiful, what would be quote unquote a beautiful sunset, would be someone we kind of go, well, there's something wrong with that person, and why did I bring them on my trip?
You know, that kind of universal reaction is much more common when you're looking at a natural artifact, something that's
versus walking through, say, the IMA.
Right, exactly. Versus something that's created by a human being, and I think that's an interesting thing. You know, that universality is definitely inspired by nature. I think it's a universal human emotion to be moved
by the sunset, the mountains,
exactly,
wildlife,
and we expect that same sort of universality when we're in front of a work of art that moves us personally. But we don't always get it, do we?
Right.
You do walk through the IMA with somebody and you see a work of art that moves you and you want to share that experience with somebody and you show it to them and they go, "Barf."
Right. Yeah.
You do get those reactions. Exactly.
Yeah,
and so let's talk a little bit about what's going on there, and then we'll move back to the Mass a second. Because I think, you know, I think to a certain extent, the ultimate aesthetic experience, that uplifting of the soul to God, I think that's why art draws us in. I think that's what all artwork aspires us to. To a certain extent, is whether it's recognized or not, a state of prayer. And that's why the liturgy is filled with art and artwork. And that's also why we have such reverence for art in general as Catholics, because I think we recognize that connection between aesthetic experience and prayer. But let's take a step back and let's talk about these two different people. You and I, Tim.
Yes.
We're down there at the IMA.
Yes.
And we're standing in front of a painting.
Yes.
You love it. I hate it. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on there and why this work of art that you seem to think demands universal appreciation. I, on the other hand, look at it and go, no, that whatever that artist was trying to do, he didn't do it.
Well, I think first I would simply say, well, I'm right and you're wrong. So just, there's my aesthetic judgment as a professional philosopher. So, well, you're right. Now we've got to kind of understand why that is. So I think one of the first things we're going to have to do is kind of understand the role of imitation, right? That the artist, what is the artist trying to do, and how well has he or she accomplished the skill in which the technique, if you will, which is what the Greek word for art, accomplish what they're doing. And then also one of the things that's almost ever present in works of art that receive a certain amount of universal acclaim is where we haven't brought up yet, but usually it's symmetry. There's a certain kind of symmetry, a certain kind of balance. St. Thomas Aquinas and his aesthetics begins to bring that up. In other words, when we think of, say the painting we're in front of that we're using now as an example is a portrait of a human being. Say maybe it's the I won't put you on the spot like the Mona Lisa because you've already said you, for the sake of the thought experiment, you're saying you don't agree with it. But when we think of like a portrait, what we're going to be looking for is initially a certain kind of balance, a certain kind of symmetry in the, say, the facial features. And so even empirical science has shown, when you think of like what goes behind, say, advertising and marketing, is that what we, glamour magazines, there's a certain balance in the person's face, in their form, in their figure, that tends to create more of a positive response in us than that which is lacking.
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things about aesthetics is in the modern world, when you talk about aesthetics and you talk about modern art to a great extent has moved beyond beauty. It's moved beyond trying to elicit aesthetic responses to a certain extent. And modern art has become almost meta art. It's art about art, and it's art for, you know, art's sake to a great extent. So taking a step back, when we talk about beauty and aesthetics, where that discussion really takes place in our modern world is around movie scores and advertising and things where artwork is still really produced to elicit that aesthetic response. Unlike at an art museum where really honestly the artwork isn't so much about the aesthetic response from the viewer as it is about all sorts of other things that are going on within the world of art and what that artist is responding to within the world of art.
Well, and I think one of the things we see, especially with modern art, is the fact that traditional art, you know, as it came up through the ages, was an attempt to recreate what creation had already put out there in front of us. Modern art tends to take the next step and say, I'm not going to recreate what's already there. I'm going to create something new. And sometimes that aesthetic to the individual who's creating it, it's like, oh, this is great. This is beautiful. A few people might understand that. A few people might look at it and go, you know what? My kindergartner paints better than that. And, you know, you're looking at things like that. You know, for example, Tim, you were talking about symmetry. Somebody find me the symmetry in a Picasso.
Right.
It's
right.
Not it's really there. But that's still considered some of the most beautiful art in the world because it's a new creation. It's a new twist on things. Are we becoming the creators now?
Well, I think that novelty is a very important aspect of this because if you go back to what Tim was saying and what you're trying to recognize is, okay, we're trying to draw out the form of something. And, you know, we recognize something as beautiful when it has those particular characteristics of perfect symmetry or perfect representation. Art would have stopped a long time ago. You know, the perfect facial representation would have been the Mona Lisa, and then art would be done. There's no improving upon it. And so, you know, we would have hit that perfect symmetry and that perfect work of art a long time ago. But there's something about the novelty involved that allows art to continue and allows art to keep moving down. So novelty, I don't think is just an aspect of modern art. That novelty is intrinsic to fine art in general. And there's like a kind of play that goes on within the art world around an idea or around a concept. And so, you know, when you look at symmetry, when you look at imitation, there's more going on than just that. There's a novelty and a new creation and a play to a certain extent with forms that goes on from artwork to artwork to artwork to artwork. And I think, you know, that that aspect of intellectual artistic play that goes on between forms is intrinsic to art, and it's also part of why we experience art and why we find art enjoyable as sort of a, you know, a day at the museum's a fun outing.
Well, you're touching on something that's really important, I think, which is around this idea of human ingenuity and innovation, which I think is ever present, right? And so that does allow the continued sort of flourishing of the arts, because there's a certain newness, freshness to it, new insights that are being gained. But what you kept saying, Mark, which I'm going to call our listeners' attention to, because I think this is where maybe sort of a traditional art form, Catholic art, if you will, differs from or distinction from modern art. You kept using the word form. I think Catholic art, sacred art, retains form. So there are things have forms, natures, essences. There's still room for ingenuity and boldness and creativity, but the Picassos, if you will, are formlessness. And that's where I think I'm going to, in my aesthetics, I'm going to say that that's the valuable distinction.
Well, we're about ready to take a break, and when we come back from the break...
I'm just getting worked up. What do you mean? Take another break.
Well, we're going to have to discuss this form versus formlessness a little bit further.
All right.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blandford, and today we are talking about aesthetics. We're talking about art, artwork, beauty, how it is we react to beautiful things, why we find beautiful things important, and more importantly, how beautiful things are produced. So right before we took our break, Tim, you had brought up this idea of a form versus formlessness, and this being a big dividing line between traditional art, and you used the term Catholic art, and modern contemporary art. Now, Kent's a musician, and he's a musician that's put on a lot of contemporary liturgies and things, and so... You know, I know one of the formless art, you know, formless types of art that gets thrown out there is jazz music. You know, jazz gets thrown out there as formless as opposed to classical music, which has a much more structured form to it. And so a lot of criticism is thrown the direction of jazz as a formless art. And so I want to throw this back to Kent a little bit into the realm of music, this formlessness of jazz versus the form of a more, you know, contemporary or a more classical piece of music. Some would say one's fitting for the mass and the other isn't because of that formlessness versus the form. What do you think?
Okay, let me start off with the jazz.
Starting jazz, off jazz mass, a jazz yeah, mass.
Actually, I've been to one.
New Orleans?
Yes. Actually, in New Orleans, I actually have been to a jazz mass. It's interesting. It's a takeoff of many of the traditional hymns, but what they did was take that and, you know, you have, quote, the ad lib of jazz, where you take a phrase and you play with it, you tweak it a little bit here, a little bit there, and what most people perceive as formlessness in jazz, if you're a really good jazz musician, you know what's going on. You know that behind that, there are chord structures that you have to stay within. There are keys that you need to work within. What appears to the individual listening as being formless, because it's different from everything else that's in that piece, is actually a new form within itself. It has to stay within certain guidelines. It's not completely, you know, made up as you go. It's ad-libbed, but it's within a framework. There is a form behind that. Just like within the Mass itself has a form. It has a formality about it. there are, as a musician, many, many great Christian songs out there that I really love. They are things that, you know, they're very beautiful. They're worship songs. They really touch the heart. They really get you going. They really rev you up. But you know what? They don't belong at a mass.
Agreed. Yeah, I think there's a particular, and I think the form to a certain extent has to match the function. You know, form and function. Yeah, that's more of a principle within architecture that, you know, form yes. follows function. But I think it applies to music and it applies to the mass as well. And the function in the mass goes back to that aesthetic experience of the worshiper. So the mass is the liturgy. It's the work of the church. And so it is the prayer of the church. And so, you know, the function there of the music, the function of the architecture, the function of the artworks within the sanctuary, all I think should lead back to really the function, which is worship, which is prayer.
You know, it's one of those things where over the years, I've watched this develop. I mean, I'm going to show my age here and the fact that the first time I ever saw a guitar used at mass, I was in the first grade, and this was just absolutely fascinating to me. I mean, it was one of those, honestly, it was a turning point in my life, because up until then, I mean, this was just after Vatican II, when, you know, all of a sudden things were starting to change, and I went to a mass. It was a first mass for a priest who had, from our parish, and they got up and they did a song with a guitar, and I was just absolutely stunned by this. They're not playing the organ, they're playing a guitar. My father has one of those in the closet at home. We own a guitar. We don't own a pipe organ, but we do own a guitar. This is right. something that suddenly it reached out to me, and it was no longer, if I wanted to be a musician in a parish, I had to be able to play the organ. I could get that out of Dad's closet, learn to play that, and I could be part of the mass. It opened a door to me, and you know, it was just that one experience, and it's changed the rest of my life. You know, I'm telling a story on myself. I went to school the next day, and our teacher was, you know, Sister Marie Padua, wonderful lady, asked how our weekend was, and I shot my hand up, and I saw, you know, I had to tell her, they played a guitar at mass yesterday. And she says, yes, I know, I was there. And they sang this song. Yes, I was there. Next thing I know, I'm singing this song and my classmates are looking at me like I've grown a third head. Well, somehow over the years, I've never stopped singing. And, you know, it's one of those things. Music to me is a very important part of the mass. And I have to have a certain respect for, while music is beautiful, music can touch the soul, music can lead you a direction, within the form of the mass, within the liturgy, there are bounds and limits, just like I talked about in jazz. There are bounds and limits as to where things fit appropriately. Music is one of those things that can lift you up or it can distract you during mass. There's a fine line. A very fine line that has to be walked, especially when you're looking at, you know, for example, a Teen Life Mass or something along those types of masses. Where's the edge? Do you step across into rock and roll, or, you know, do you stick with the traditional? I've been at parishes that have done everything across the board. I've also been struck by the number of parishes who, from an aesthetic standpoint, have completely gone to almost a barren landscape in which the mass is held. Most new churches are not as ornate as the old ones. I mean, I grew up with seeing parishes like the old Holy Trinity here in Indianapolis has an absolutely beautiful ornate altar setting. St. Michael's down in Kendleton, where my family was from, at one point, they cleared out the altar. They took all of that out. And then a few years later, it came back.
Oh.
People started to appreciate that beauty again.
Yes.
And the mass feels completely different when you're surrounded by beautiful setting than if you're sitting in a stark white church.
Yeah, there was a move, and I think it was a reaction to what was going on in the aesthetics of the modern age. There was a move to take away all symbolism. And I think that's really what that move to kind of whitewash the walls of the church. It was part of
get rid of the statues, the paintings.
Right, but it was a reaction.
So it can focus on.
Right, but I think it stemmed from, you know, movements within philosophy, which percolated into the art realm and aesthetics, of a reaction against symbolism. So anything that represented something else, we were suddenly, we couldn't determine the meaning of it. And so it goes back to we've talked about nominalism, we've talked about the idea that that form, you know, the forms that we recognize, that the modern world in a lot of ways it tries to deny that idea. And so when you took away the form, suddenly you couldn't have something referring to something else. And so artwork became non-symbolic. And so the symbolism yes. within artwork then disappeared. And that trickled into our church. It trickled into our churches, and we suddenly wound up casting out the statues and whitewashing the walls. And it had a lot of effects, but I think it all stems back from this sort of aesthetic movement that happened out in the real world. And so, I find that sort of a fascinating move that even affected us at Catholic liturgy.
Yes.
You know, I kind of wonder if some of that we saw with, you know, the whitewashing of the walls and the removal of some of the more ornate points within the church, most of that happened almost immediately after Vatican II. Were we, do you think, possibly giving in to that old, you know, Protestant accusation that we're worshiping statues?
Well, you were mentioning the music and how the form of the music differs from parish to parish now. And Vatican II was very much about drawing the laity into the liturgy. Prior to Vatican II, I think there was this view that the priest was the one that said Mass. We went and we watched Mass being said.
Yeah, we attended.
We attended, but we didn't participate. And so the church very much tried to correct that through Vatican II and bring the laity into participation. And so they opened the doors for new forms of music, for guitars, to be able to draw us in.
So maybe that, drums even.
As you said, that opened up the ability for you as an ordinary layperson to be able to participate. It's not that lay people couldn't participate before, but now it was a much more visible, tangible type of participation that we had in our Mass. But in that bringing in the laity, we also brought in, I think, some of the errors that were out there in the world that, you know, gets carried by the laity like an infection sometimes.
Well, I think we get swept up with novelty.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about that. You know, we like to, you know, just human beings, we like to kind of go with the, you know, especially Americans, Westerners, we like to go with where where things are progressing and like that. And I think, too, an important part, I agree with what you guys have said. I also seem to recall part of our history is that you have in the secular world, you have in the 30s, you begin to have this movement among German architects that began to move towards what? Steel, glass, this form follows function kind of stuff. And then what happens is they're kind of chased out of Germany because of the rise of National Socialism, and they wind up here in America, some of these prominent German architects, they wind up at Harvard, they wind up at Illinois Institute of Technology, and they begin to, what, influence American architecture. Now, my understanding, too, is that there was a very prominent priest, Holy Cross priest out of Notre Dame, who was a liturgist, but also very much involved in sacred space, sacred architecture, sacred art, who also becomes enamored with this movement. So now we're moving into the 40s. And in the 40s, we also have a move in sort of the French Catholic world, this Nouveau Theologia, right? The new theology. And so all of this begins to kind of swirl together. So you have calls for liturgical reform, renewal, more participation of laity. This, I think, puts us on the trajectory where you have Vatican II, you have a cultural revolution in the West, and when you want greater participation of the laity, and if you're now of the mindset in the 60s now where, hey, form follows function, well, you're going to want your churches not to be so much in a basilica cruciform anymore, but you want more the amphitheater, because you want what? More of, now the priest has turned around, the priest is now facing the laity, you want the laity participating more. So this is where we begin to, so I think our listeners, if you think about when you look at modern churches, when they're built and why the change, I think this is a big reason why.
Well, we need to take another break, but when we come back, well, let's talk more about this form follows function idea and how it percolated into our church.
Here at Catholic Radio Indy, we guarantee you will be getting 100% Catholic programming 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Evangelization, catechesis, apologetics, and so much more, all in keeping with the teaching of the Catholic Church. On the air at 89.1 and 90.9 FM, online at CatholicRadioIndy.org, and on the go with a free app for your smartphone or mobile device, Catholic Radio Indy, 100% Catholic programming 24/7.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. We're here with Mark Tuttle, Kent Blandford. I'm Timothy O'Donnell. And we've been talking about aesthetics. And when we just left off in that third segment, and as we kind of round the corner here in this last part of the show, we were just talking, Mark, about sort of this movement that begins in the 30s, 40s, 50s, this sort of change in architecture. Tell us a little bit about what you think was going on there.
Well, I think to really understand what happened in the 30s and 40s, you have to go even further back in the history of aesthetics.
You are always taking us a step back, brother. I love that.
Well, we had talked
about... That's what we're here to do in the cave, right? Get at what's behind. All
exactly.
Right.
Well, we talked earlier in the show about the role that imitation plays within art and artwork. And for a long time, what was seen as beautiful was that which captured the essence of whatever object was trying to be replicated. So, a beautiful bird was whatever piece of art could capture that, the birdness of the bird, or the form
essence
of the bird, the mm-hmm. essence of the bird. And what happened is, with modern philosophy and the modern age, that idea that there are forms, that there are essences, that there are things that are, represented by material forms, that idea went out the window. And suddenly you had this almost nominalistic view of symbols, of artwork, and what was there on the canvas was simply what was there on the canvas. What was there in the artwork was simply what was there in the artwork. And so within the world of architecture, when you get to the 1930s and 1940s, there was nothing other than the functionality of a building left to be reproduced in a building. And so the idea that form follows function started to permeate. And so people mm-hmm. looked for, and I think also, I think science and technology plays a lot into this too. We suddenly had the ability to create steel buildings and glass buildings.
Skyscrapers.
Mm-hmm. And so we wound up with this idea that form follows function, and functionality is the only important part within a building. And so the entire architecture of a building had to basically be based around what the function of that building was. And as you mentioned, this was a movement within Germany. The German architecture school, the Bauhaus, was pretty
much
where this idea originated from. Mies van der Rohe was one of the more prominent architects. And yeah, he came over to America. The convention center there in Chicago is a Mies mm-hmm. van der Rohe building. So if any of our listeners are up in Chicago and you're driving down the highway and you see that convention center, you'll know what we're talking about. The whole structure of that building, the architecture, the materials, every choice that Mies van der Rohe had to go into designing that building was based around the function of that space as a convention center, as a trade space, and everything follows from that. And so that idea then went into the building of churches. The whole structure of the church follows from the function of what's going on in that space, the coming together of the people, the people there centered around the altar. So you wind up, rather than the cruciform, traditional form of a Gothic cathedral, you wind up with this amphitheater centered around
the
altar.
Seating.
Theater seating, right.
Yeah.
But it's all to center us there on the altar. The
right.
altar then becomes the centerpiece of the church. You know, there's some good, there's some maybe some bad that that some people might think about within this movement, but it was all a movement for the form to follow the function. Now then, after that, people began to realize, wait a second, there is more than just the functionality going on here.
And
people began to realize, you know, the statues that used to permeate, you know, it brought the presence of the saints there by representing them. And the idea of representational art being part of the worship, that began to come back again. And so you started to see a movement to bring icons back to the churches and to bring statues back to the churches. So there's got to be a balance there, I think, between the representational there to move us to see higher things than are what's physically present, but also that idea that, you know, the building, the space, everything that we're in really is there for the function of us worshiping, and it's there to lift our spirits up to God.
Yeah, if you want to see a perfect example of the return to the beauty within the church and those kinds of things, look up St. John Cantius Parish in Chicago. The Brothers of St. John Cantius up there, as one of their charisms, their focus is return beauty to the church. It's not only the physical beauty of the church, but these are brothers who sing the Liturgy of the Hours every day in choir. Wow. It's an absolutely beautiful movement. So look it up, Google it, St. John Cantius. They're one of the groups that's kind of taking that step back.
And they've preserved the not only the traditional Latin Mass, but they also have the Novus Ordo Mass done in a very traditional, beautiful form.
And maybe the way it was intended.
Maybe the way it was intended. And, you know, I think that's an important thing when we're talking about, you know, the Latin within it. The Latin itself, the language that the Mass is expressed in, becomes a symbol. And so, mm-hmm. you know, that very, you know, the very use of Latin within the Mass is symbolic of the historical continuity of the teaching of the church, the universality of the church. The very language itself becomes a symbol that some people want to preserve. Now, sometimes those symbols can stand in the way of us being able to fully participate. And so, you know, there's that balance again. And I think every liturgist has looked at this and said, you know, what do I need to do with my particular parish to achieve that perfect balance of participation from the laity, but at the same time, preservation of the content of the Mass that's there.
Well, and that continuity is so important. I know I appreciate when going to Mass, when some parts of the Mass are retained in Latin. There's something very powerful and moving to me. Let's say the Our Father, the Pater Noster is said in Latin, and which calls to mind, like, these are the exact words St. Augustine used, you know, 1600 years ago, and all these great saints. And so I appreciate that. And so I think you're right. It's a balance, but it's the continuity. It's the preserving of the tradition and yet always making it fresh, new, inviting, right? Recognizing that there's room for not novelty, but development.
Right. Now, so far, our discussion has centered around the Mass and the use of art and aesthetics within the church. What role do we as Catholics have within aesthetics outside of Mass, beautifying the world? Is there a role for a Catholic artist out there for, you know, the fine arts?
I think there is, and I think especially where I would love to see that is in Hollywood. You're starting to see more and more Christian movies, more movies with more uplifting themes coming out. And, you know, for years, that was just, you know, antithetical to the concept of a Hollywood movie. You could not do something like that. People wouldn't go to a movie like that. They're not going to waste their money on movies like that. And yet, we see these movies coming out. They're making the money. They're drawing crowds. And now, all of a sudden, let's put it this way, Hollywood is catching on and starting to produce these kinds of movies, but I don't really think they're doing it for the right reasons. They're doing it because there's a buck to be made.
Yeah, and I think there's a tension there. I think it's interesting that on the one hand, you know, you've got a large push within our culture for more Christian content to be out there, but the artistry oftentimes is lacking. And so I think within the realm of aesthetics, you wind up with inferior art being produced in the name of Christ. And you almost wind up with, you know, people sort of trading off of the name of God, even though, you know, their particular movie or their particular music wouldn't cut it, I think, out there in the secular world.
Yeah, I know for the longest time there were jokes within the Christian music community that, well, the only reason why that person's a Christian musician is because they couldn't make it in the real world. Now, in movies and things like that, I think what we're starting to see is, you know, yes, Hollywood is making Christian-themed movies, but they're making it from the Hollywood perspective and not from the Christian perspective, which unfortunately means that what you have is Hollywood, who has all the technology, has all the bells and whistles that it takes to make a big feature film, but they don't have the heart behind it. But then you have these Christian groups that are out there trying to make feature films. They don't have the bells and whistles and the technology, but the heart sure is there.
Well, and I think to the broader question too, what is one is to that brings up the point of why the sometimes the Christian films feel like they're kind of B-rated. You know, they fall a little bit short than like you're pointing us to, like the latest, say, Star Wars movie, filled with, you know, every imaginable piece of technology to really stupefy us almost with the glamour of it all. I do think, though, getting back to your question earlier, Mark, about, you know, is there a call for Catholics, Christians to go forth and develop, bring beauty into the world? I would say absolutely. And here's why. The world is fallen. This is a fallen world. And if we're called as Catholics and Christians to what? Evangelize. Beauty, I think, is one of the, if not the leading tool in evangelization, because beauty has that universal quality that we were talking about earlier in the show. People of any background can appreciate beauty. And here's that move that I think that's so helpful with evangelization when we think about beauty, is that once we see something as beautiful, we can then acknowledge the truth of the statement. This is beautiful. Now I've got, so beauty is one of the transcendentals. Then I can make a quick move to the recognition of the truth of the statement. So now I've got myself another of the transcendentals. And then the last one is, I see the logic that connects those two, and the beauty, the truth of it, and I recognize that it's good, that this beautiful thing is good in and of itself. And now I've got the building blocks of faith. I've got the true, the good, and the beautiful.
Yeah, I think that evangelistic side of art is something that all Catholics really ought to recognize. And we started talking about, you know, ISIS and militant Islam's reaction against beautiful works of art. And, you know, they're very iconoclastic. They want to destroy as much that doesn't agree with their theology as they possibly can. And we talked about how Catholicism very much contradicts that, to the point where we embrace a lot of pagan art. And it's exactly that recognition of the universality of the transcendentals, the universality of truth, the universality of beauty, the universality of goodness, that we can recognize even in an artwork that was produced by another human being that may not necessarily have come to Christ yet, but we can see the kernels, their beginning, in that artwork of acknowledging something that's beautiful that transcends us.
Well, and that's going to bring us to what? The source of all beauty is our Lord, right? Kent, take us home.
Okay. I'm going to toss a challenge out there for everybody. We're going to take aesthetics and let's take a step and put a little evangelization behind that. I want you to find a friend, someone who you might want to try to bring into the church. Point out the beauty of the world first. Then take him to a museum. Point out the beauty of the arts and everything there. And then top it off. Take him to Mass, where they can see, hear, and feel the beauty of God's creation all in one place. That's it for the Cave for this week. We'll catch you next week. Thanks. Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.